interview with Hugh Cleland of the History Department.
Let's move it to here, and that'll save a long hours. All right. You ready to go?
Yeah.
I am Hugh G. Cleland. I'm in the History Department, where I'm an associate professor. I came to Stony Brook in 1962 at the age of 40. I came from the University of Pittsburgh, and certainly one reason why I came to Stony Brook was that I was anxious to leave the University of Pittsburgh. It was an old university. It had done fairly well during the bulge of enrollment with the GI Bill, but it hadn't really adapted itself to modern times, and it was a private school, and it lost financial support to the point where the last year I was there, they didn't replace burned-out light bulbs. And that's a bad sign.
Yes.
They didn't accession any new books in the library. And the year after I left, they actually missed faculty payrolls, which is sort of unheard of in academia.
Had the tower been built?
Oh, yes.
The tower
was built in the during the Depression. Pitt had been involved in a dispute with the American Association of University Professors in the late 30s and had been on the unfair list. People were asked not to go there and to try to leave if they could, and many did, so that the senior faculty were, first of all, tired from all the years of the war and the years of the GI Bill and from the commotions that had gone on, so that it didn't seem like it had a whole lot of future to it. Now, many of the things I didn't like about Pitt made Stony Brook very attractive.
How did you hear about Stony Brook?
Well, for one thing, I had taught a couple summers at Fredonia Summer School, so I was aware of the SUNY system. There was a general feeling in the profession that a SUNY was a rising, improving, exciting sort of place to be, anywhere at SUNY. And being near New York City was especially attractive. So when I was looking around to leave Pittsburgh, I was at an American Historical Association meeting and was interviewed by people from the Stony Brook History Department.
Who were they?
Well, Dick Morse.
Oh, yes.
Bernard Semmel. Mm-hmm. And another English historian who left shortly afterwards. I've been trying to say his name. He's up in Boston now. Roger, somebody, it'll come to me in the course of the interview, perhaps. And it was fairly hectic, as those interviews often are. At Pittsburgh, football was everything. And if you gave a football player a D, somehow, miraculously, it turned into a B in the registrar's office. So that was disquieting. There was an assistant coach who kept files of examinations and term papers, and he provided them to football players, and that was discouraging. Football players were given jobs as janitors, and they went through your wastebasket in your office when they, I don't say they all did, but that was kind of the practice. So if you were going to throw away notes for a test, you took it home. You didn't throw it away there. Now, linked to that were very well-established fraternity systems who did the same thing, who kept files of tests, who kept papers that brothers could use over and over again, and who constantly embroiled the university with the police. Alumni would come back for football games, they would drink too much, they would stay at the fraternity houses, and some would become rowdy, and there were terrible town-gown relations so that people would call the police. Or there was a spring carnival where fraternities built booths, and they would steal lumber from construction sites to build their booths or that sort of thing, and the police would be called in. I was once at a faculty party near the university and was almost arrested by mistake from police who were looking for a rowdy party. The other thing was that Pitt did not have dormitories at the time, so that it was a streetcar college, and therefore there was very little intellectual life in the evening. People came on the streetcar, they went to their classes, they went home again. The only residences were the fraternities and sororities. Furthermore, as with many big city schools, it was in an inner city, declining, crime-prone area. There was a big evening school of people who were getting engineering degrees or accounting degrees or something like that, and one of the continuing problems was streetwalkers who came in the evening and hung around the cafeteria and places like that and solicited business. Also, the stadium where the Pittsburgh Pirates played was just a couple blocks from the school, and when they were in town, parking was just out of the question. And there were people like you get now at Shea Stadium that drank too much and then wandered around. So that Stony Brook did not have Greek letter organizations or houses. SUNY did not have big-time football, and there were dormitories. Furthermore, I was very impressed when I later came for another interview with the student body. An extraordinary large number seemed to be the children of New York City public school teachers, and they read newspapers, and they were better prepared academically than the sort of students that we had gotten at Pitt. In addition, the area was extraordinarily attractive, the surrounding area, and I thought that our...
You looked at planting fields?
You came in 62.
Yes.
The year that we moved out.
Yes.
But you were interviewed probably at Planting Fields.
I was interviewed at Planting Field, but I came out and looked around here.
I see.
I thought that the association with Brookhaven National Laboratory was a priceless asset in terms of a body of scientists, equipment, that sort of thing. After all, this was the age of Sputnik, and I know that many of my colleagues at University of Pittsburgh complained about antiquated equipment and inadequate support, and so Brookhaven Lab seemed to be a very great asset, as did being close to New York City. It's hard to imagine the cultural magnet that New York City is to people out in the Midwest. I remember when I was an undergraduate at West Virginia University, one of the other students, who was a veteran as I was, lived up on top of a mountain, and when the weather was right, he could get WQXR, the classical music station of the New York Times, and that was almost a visit to paradise. So that the libraries in New York and the New York City area, the easy access to Washington, D.C., and Boston, and New Haven, the whole East Coast corridor, for historians who are dependent upon depositories, seemed very, very attractive. So I can't remember now the year when Sputnik went up.
57.
57.
Yes.
Yes. Right. So when I was interviewed, it was the Long Island Center, and it was to train primarily science teachers. Well, I thought that would mean good students and good support, since that was sort of a growth industry, and since I taught history of labor relations and industrial development and economic history, I had a good deal of interest in that, so that my understanding when I came was that it would be a school for primarily for science teachers. Now, almost at once, the decision was made to become a full university center, and that seemed even more exciting so that was a plus also. When I came, the question is, what were your impressions of Stony Brook when you first came? The campus, the people, the leadership, the spirit. The campus was under construction, but that was exciting. One used to see foxes when one went across campus. Lots of people in the three villages kept horses, and they would ride to school and tie their horses to trees in the parking lot. The train was a plus, to be able to drive or to go into New York City without parking and read while you were going in. The ferry to Connecticut, being able to walk to school.
What about the cost of the housing?
Well, it was cheaper than housing in developed cities. So I moved into a development where you could have a faculty meeting in the evening. The adjoining lot was where George Williams in biology lived. Reuben Welch was a neighbor. Bernard Tunick was a neighbor. Frank Earth was a neighbor. Estelle James was a neighbor. You could have put together a faculty for a four-year college in the neighborhood. That was a plus.
That area was called what?
Nassiquag Ridge.
Nassiquag Ridge.
Yes. And it abutted the campus, really. The faculty were a little bit of a zoo, to tell you the truth. What do they say? De mortuis nisi bono. Of the dead say nothing but good. But I must say that Ben Nelson was a terrible problem. I think if I had known all the shenanigans he would be involved in, I would have gone, stayed where I was and missed payrolls. One of the things I remember was that the first year somebody was leaking hostile stories about the university to the New York Times. And I saved those for many years, and last night I tried to find them. And I found all kinds of interesting things, but I didn't find them. But I'm sure they're preserved. That was very disquieting.
If you come across them and don't want to keep them, let Averett Folkers have them.
I will.
In special collection.
But they would be in the microfilms at the time, so they could be they could be reconstructed. Now, I think that was Ben Nelson who was doing that, as nearly as I can tell. He was a professor of history, sociology, and anthropology. Or he was professor of a chairman of a department.
Sociology
and anthropology.
Yes, at the time.
Though we didn't have any anthropologists, and professor of history, and he didn't want any of those three departments to do anything that he didn't approve of. History had a little independence from him and was able to do things in spite of him. The other thing was he took books out of the library and wouldn't bring them back. And we didn't have so many books in those days.
Did you ever see his library in his house?
Well, it was sort of synonymous with our own.
Terrific library.
Yeah, but a lot of them were our books. Another thing that I ran into early on was some kind of a feud between alumni of the University of Chicago and alumni of Columbia over the shape of the curriculum. And first of all, that seemed destructive. And secondly, I was fairly familiar with the Columbia program, which I thought was a good one. I wasn't familiar with the Chicago one, but its disciples here, it seemed to me, had an approach that would make it very difficult to build a graduate center. So many issues were fought out and appointments made between these two factions.
Competing points of view, divisional structure of the faculty versus departmental structure.
Yes.
And Ben Nelson in committees was an obstructionist, kind of negative I soon realized that I had gotten into a place where the faculty was split.
Yes.
Yeah. And I began to hear everything about Oyster Bay. And one day, one professor of philosophy came in to my office, just unannounced. And shortly after we had gotten started talking, he said, "This place is going to go to the dogs unless you fire this person and that person." That's a philosopher. He's supposed to be...
Yes. Yeah, detached. Well, I remember some of my scientific colleagues telling me in some horror that at Oyster Bay they were not supposed to teach at the undergraduate level physics, chemistry, or biology, but rather that a group of them would teach a course on the eye, and that biologists, physicists, and chemists would take part in that, and that then the following year they would give a course on the liver or something like that. And it seemed to me there were several problems with that. One is, you shouldn't revise your basic course every year. The second thing is, you can't build a graduate center without strong departments. Divisions seemed to me to be the mark of a two-year college or an evening division program. So that was very influential at the time and very vexing. I was somewhat shocked when I arrived to discover that Dick Morse, who had hired me, had resigned. And there was a new chairperson that I'd never met. It was Stanley Ross. Stanley had flaws, but he was energetic and ambitious, and he was committed to the departmental system. And I think he rallied support for that and sort of got us onto that track and away from the divisional model. So he's certainly one of the people that I remember as being extremely influential in the early years. Also, Harry Kalish, who had self-confidence, and that helps. It's even better if there's some basis for being self-confident. But I think he was professionally competent, as nearly as I can tell. And Alex Pond.
Alex came the same year you and I did.
Yes, yes. And these were all people who were willing to put in 14, 16-hour days for the institution. And many, many nights I ate supper and read the paper and came back and worked in my office till midnight, involved in recruiting. And that was really the major job in the early years, because Sputnik and the baby boom were leading to an explosion of graduate centers. Every province in Canada suddenly decided they needed a PhD granting institution. I remember that North Carolina announced 62, 63, 64, they were going to build four additional PhD granting institutions. And I guess they did, but they're academically invisible places like East Carolina University or wherever.
Well, there's Greensboro. assistant. One of John Toll's assistants, Bill Moran, is now president.
Uh-huh. Well, they're there, but yeah, they're certainly not turning out potential Pulitzer Prize winners. So the result was there was a furious scramble for people who could teach graduate courses, who were visible in their profession, and particularly who were qualified in esoteric fields, which required Chinese, Latin, Greek, German, French, history of science, that sort of thing. So that it was very important to do thorough searches and to build thorough dossiers on people to collect files, collect letters of reference, and to keep a very sharp eye out for cousins of people already on the faculty who were, attempts were being made to sort of smuggle in. Now, the Pitt History Department, before I left, had made a valiant attempt to upgrade itself and failed not because of departmental considerations, but because of institutional considerations. But we had used what was called the Iowa system of recruiting, which involves asking a person to give a talk, asking everybody in the department to read the person's publications, carefully ranking people before you invited them in, arranging them for them to meet undergraduates and later graduates. And it was very methodical, and as impartial as humans can be, and I became the acting chair at a time when we would get 5 positions a year to fill. And that meant we were in competition with Canada, California, Carolina, Northern Illinois, all sorts of places. And very often, we appointed the 5th person on our list. But if you tried to identify all the good people and tried to have good dossiers, you could appoint the 5th person or the 4th person, and they'd still be pretty good. And given the right kind of teaching load and atmosphere and students, could become very good professors.
One reason I appointed Stan Ross Dean was that I liked the way he was going at the search for candidates.
Yes.
I liked that very much. And of course, being an historian, at least by training, I could appreciate what he was doing.
Uh-huh.
Who brought in Tom Angris, do you know?
Yes, Bernard Semmel and Stanley and myself were involved in interviewing him and bringing him in.
That was a good appointment.
Yes, it was. Although he was one of those, it was not our first choice.
Mm-hmm.
But then, to add to that, we had to start recruiting graduate students very early. And I spent an enormous amount of time on that. We got a list of the people who had been alternates for Woodrow Wilson
mm-hmm.
fellowships.
Mm-hmm.
and we called them up personally. And I think the first year we began a graduate program, we had 7 alternates who were Woodrow Wilsons. Mm-hmm. Alternates. Alternates. Now, if we hadn't called them, never would have gotten them.
That's right.
But it got us started out.
When was that? Do you have any idea when the history department got the green light to go into graduate school?
I don't remember the year, but it was early on.
Yeah. Was the department in any way reviewed by external reviewers before the application to went to Albany for graduate work?
Yes, it was.
You know who they were?
Well, one of them was a fellow named Lord, who had written an historical atlas I'd used, Lord and Lord's Historical Atlas. I think he was an administrator at NYU or somewhere, but he was one.
Because that was the procedure.
Yes.
That we set up.
Yes.
First at Stony Brook, and then Harry Porter said he was going to have that put through throughout the system.
That was a good procedure.
Right.
That was a good procedure. There was a concern with standards and with process and a feeling that you didn't dare make mistakes. That you were really, you know.
Yeah. Well, you were building for a long time.
Yes, that's right. And you make a bad appointment, you live with it the rest of your career. And we made some bad ones, and we've lived with them, and so on. Now, in addition to that, I was on endless search committees. I remember being on a search committee for director of libraries, and on a search committee for chair of the sociology department when Ben was somehow sent on vacation to the Black Sea or something. I don't remember how they got him out there. I sent him off like they send off Russians who are about to be purged from the Politburo. In addition to that, we were overseeing buildings, the construction of buildings, so that I ended up somehow as chair of a committee to work with the architects and the contractors to build the lecture center. It wasn't a departmental facility. If you build a biology building, the biologists do it. If you build a chemistry building, the chemists do it. We don't have a lecture department. So I was chair of the committee that did that, and
That's now called the Javits Center.
Now called the Javits Center.
Right.
But getting the necessary audio-visual equipment in, making sure it was safe, and getting it finished so you could have big classes. Everything was needed yesterday. So I spent a number of years on that and learned to read engineering drawings and to talk to contractors. And we had a resident fellow in charge of construction who was amusing, but he was totally incompetent. He had an Italian name. He was a little fellow.
Capello?
What?
Capello? Joe Capello?
I think it was Joe Capello. And I went on for about a year, depending on his advice, and discovered he didn't even have files. He sort of did things out of his hat. And so that was distressing. We used to spend hours and hours marking secondhand book catalogs for the library. And you couldn't put it off. If you put it off, somebody else got it. So you're under great pressure, and we phoned in orders to get things in. And it had to be done for a graduate program. But,
now let's see, was Roscoe Rouse there then? Did you have a hand in bringing him in, or he was librarian?
Yes.
Before that, I think Reuben Welch.
Yes. I did. And then in finding a replacement for him. I was chair of the library committee. And he was a little culturally out of tune with us Yankees. He was a Southern Baptist. He felt many books should be kept locked in his office. And not everybody should have access to them. And that was philosophically objectionable to scholars and sort of a jarring note.
This wasn't the concept of a rare book room.
No, of erotic books.
Oh, I see.
Books that had bad words in them, that sort of thing. The bad words appeared by magic on the fences surrounding our construction site, so he wasn't really protecting anybody from anything, but he was
he was trained, and you had money to work with then.
Yes. There was a lovely lady from Lexington, Kentucky, who was the acquisitions librarian. Hadn't thought of her for a long time, but she was wonderful.
That's vital for the humanities.
Yes, indeed it was. I must say, though, that recruiting graduate students, building buildings, ordering books, pretty much sucked up one's time, or my time anyway, and I had hoped to spend lots of time at the Library of Congress and Columbia Library and New York Public, and never was able to do very much of that, but it seemed to be the indicated thing to do, to sort of work on institution building,
right,
and infrastructure building,
right.
And I think it was the right decision, and now there are books there that I've ordered in 64, and every semester I teach in the Javits Center, and I like the equipment and the system, and so that is very satisfying.
Well, you made a real contribution to the building of the university.
Certainly with many other people. Of course, relations with the town were not so good, particularly with the man who was publisher of the Three Village Herald at the time. But I was always very fond of Ward Melville. And
I think we all were. He was a great person.
He was remarkably cultured. He was an outstanding gentleman historian and gentleman architect.
Columbia class of '09.
Uh-huh. A number of occasions I profited from chatting with him. He got the schools off to a good start, the public schools. He brought in first-rate people in one capacity or another. There was a fellow named Charles Herman. Did you ever meet Charlie Herman?
I don't think so. I don't remember, anyway.
He had been a...
Incidentally, the editor of the Herald was Bud Huber.
Yes, yes. He didn't much like us.
No.
Yes. This Charles Herman had been research assistant to Charles Beard when he wrote Economic Interpretation, the Constitution, Economic Interpretation of Jeffersonian Democracy. He was a prince from Russia who had left after the revolution, came here to start over, and Melville hired him to tutor his kids. So he was a tutor. Melville wanted his kids to learn French. They wouldn't learn French. Melville went to Switzerland and hired a French-speaking Swiss cavalry sergeant and brought him to this country and said to the kids, if you want to learn to ride, you have to learn French. And they did. Did you ever hear that story?
No, I never heard that.
Yeah.
Very good.
And his name was Mollet, M-O-L-L-E-T.
He's probably not living now.
He's not, but his son is.
Is that right?
His son is named Gus Mollet, and he still lives in the area.
I see.
Paul Gelinas, who was a school superintendent. Was somebody that Melville had brought in. He lavished a lot of attention on the public schools, and that made it easier to recruit people. And certainly another part of my professional life at that time was driving people around Suffolk County and hoping that would substitute for the fact that we lacked certain journals and certain collections and other amenities that a competing school might have. And I think over and over again, someone would come in to MacArthur Airport and feel we were second or third choices. And by the time you'd taken them through Head of the Harbor and Old Stony Brook and Old Field and Port Jefferson, you had them. But it required hours and hours of careful planning and careful driving to sort of keep them out of some of the tracked houses.
Filling in the context, the atmosphere of the surroundings.
Yeah.
We're not part of New York City in that sense.
Yes, but now that this is just anecdotal, but over and over again, people coming from Europe.
Still going.
Or wherever, would get off a plane at Kennedy, get in a taxi, and say, take me to Stony Brook. They would arrive and they would owe $80. And they would come in, and we'd all go through our wallets and our desks and run down the hall to borrow some money from Howard Scarrow to pay the cab fare. Or they would call up from Penn Station and say, here I am, which subway do I take? So, the schools, the housing, the ambiance in general, we couldn't have done what we have done had we been in Red Bank, New Jersey, or Long Island City, or any number of other places. So it was, sometimes things work out.
Yes.
Right. And it's certainly gratifying.
Well, Johnny Toe, one time said that after he retired from Maryland, he thought he'd come back up here.
Uh-huh, sure.
Now, he may change his mind, but his mother-in-law is still here in Belterre.
Uh-huh. I wouldn't think of leaving the Three Village area.
No.
I really wouldn't.
Well, where are you now? Let's see. I'm on a set of questions.
Yeah.
You want to take up... anything further on 9? Did you have relations with the administration? What was your feeling about the nature of the administration, let's say under John Toll?
Yeah.
Or under me, for that matter?
Yeah. Well, of course, you were intimately involved, being an historian, with our department, and your prior service at Brookhaven was enormously helpful to us, so that you were able to talk to people from...